Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks, which is actually a very special one, two times over, which we will explain shortly. But first, Carly.
A reminder, this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And a reminder about all the ways you can support us as a show, rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And of course, follow us on our Substack newsletter, get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. And now to Cece.
A very special announcement. We have just reached 3 million downloads. We are so happy. We're over the moon excited. And what a special, special day it is that we have an author on the show with us. So our show is all about helping writers, all about making publishing more accessible. And so the perfect episode in which we can celebrate the 3 million downloads is one where we have the author with us. So thank you.
Yeah, we really wanted to have an author here today because it's thanks to you, our listeners, that we've reached this epic, epic milestone. Thank you for your incredible support. Thank you for spreading the word. And we look forward to many more millions with you. Right now, I get to welcome our author today, Ron Morgan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Congratulations. I had no idea I was going to be here for the 3 million download. That's amazing. It's such a remarkable achievement, and it's been so helpful to me, and I hope will be helpful to a lot of other writers too.
Thank you, Ron. It's kind of like stumbling into a party, right? You're like,
right, exactly.
What are these people celebrating? Well, anyway, we may not have told you about the party, but we have invited you and we're really glad to have you here. So as per usual, we're going to kick things right off, Ron, and we're going to ask you to please read us your query letter.
Dear Cece, I'm a huge fan of the podcast and I'm currently loving my first deep dive with you, Carly, and Bianca. On your manuscript wish list, you said you'd like novels about dysfunctional wealthy families, morally ambiguous protagonists, and best friendships in high-stakes situations. My debut novel, Noble Rot, approximately 95,000 words, a literary crime story set in the high-flying world of New York City fine dining, checks all three of those boxes. I'd be thrilled if you'd consider representing it. Restaurateur Arthur Plaid's Giro Rosto was once the most impossible-to-get reservation in Manhattan. Now, broke and nearing 40, he's stuck sharing a one-bedroom apartment in Queens with his estranged father and his ex-girlfriend's parrot, while desperately scheming to save his restaurant from eviction. How far will he go to get his old life back? When Arthur's best friend, socialite Dale Fender, inherits nothing except his Wall Street tycoon father's famous wine collection, Arthur seizes on the opportunity to help him sell it, but the wine turns out to be damaged and worthless. Undeterred, Arthur and Dale conspire to make and sell painstakingly forged facsimiles of rare wine to New York City's wealthiest collectors. When Texas oil baron Lamar Tent purchases the entire cellar, Dale takes the money and disappears, while Arthur loses everything and must close his restaurant. After Dale's dead body is fished out of the Long Island Sound, news of the fraud is leaked to Lamar, and Arthur must prove he wasn't involved in Dale's death and convince Lamar that he's better off keeping the fake wine and preserving his reputation than turning Arthur over to the police. Noble Rot is a story about class, the lure of restaurant life, fathers and sons, and the idiosyncrasies of male friendship. Equal parts Stephanie Dandler's Sweet Bitter and Dwyer Murphy's An Honest Living, it will attract the restaurant curious who binge-watched The Bear and readers who enjoyed Shangri-La's My Year Abroad. Like Arthur, I have worked 20 years as a general manager, wine director, sommelier, and captain in Michelin-starred and recognized restaurants in New York City. Noble Rot was developed and workshopped at Stanford University's online novel writing certificate program, which I completed in 2021. I have an undergraduate theater degree from Northwestern University, have been a fiction reader for the Chestnut Review, and I'm currently the director of operations for Verve Wine. Thank you for your time and consideration. All my best, Ron Morgan.
Wonderful, Ron. Thank you so much for that. We're going to throw it to Carly and Cece, who will give us feedback on the query, and then we'll come back to you to see if you have any questions or anything you'd like to add to that before we move on to your pages. Cece, would you like to kick us off?
Yes. Let me start off by saying that this is a very well-written query letter, like very, very polished. You did an amazing job with the setup. I was very impressed. I actually highlighted the first paragraph and I was like, oh, good job with the setup. I'm already curious because the contrast between his old life and his current predicament, like it's such a big contrast, and contrast always helps with curiosity, right? So that was really excellent. I want to mention a tiny, tiny thing. I don't think you need to use italics for the name of the restaurant. It made me think it might be the title, but then I knew it wasn't the title because of the first paragraph. So I don't think you need it. I could be wrong, but I don't think we italicized restaurant names. And I do wonder whether you're giving too much away with the plot points. Usually it's the other way around. Usually writers don't give enough away. And I like that you're here with us because I can ask you, like, the plot points that are laid out, do they happen pre-climax? Like, are we going all the way up till the climax? Are we, you know, going over the climax? So, you know, once we throw it off to you, you'll be able to answer these questions. Because I do wonder, maybe that's a conversation we can have. I really like that there's a lot happening. I love the author bio. I think it's really well written. And I just really want to emphasize how this query letter is incredibly well written and so polished. If this landed in my inbox, I'd be very excited to keep scrolling and read the pages because it's doing its job. It's making me curious. It's establishing a really strong hook, really interesting characters. I know what specific plot questions to ask. So overall, 5 stars, congratulations. And Carly, what do you think?
All right. So I always just gravitate towards titles off the top because it's one of the first kind of points in the query letter itself. I love this title. This is a great, great, great title. I think this is a huge win. I like the 2-word title and both of them are really interesting. Kind of reminds me, it's completely different, but like Big Swiss, where it's just like the 2-word title, 2 interesting words. And when they're put together, it's just interesting. So I think you did a really, really great job with that. Overall, the first time I read the query letter, I don't think I made a single note because I was just like really into it. I wanted to see where it was going to go. I often say that the comp titles and that need to go at the top. But I felt like for this specific example, because obviously you addressed it to CC, you know, you were kind of pulling out specific things from manuscript wish list. I felt like it worked okay that you had the comp titles down below. But if you were writing this for somebody else and you didn't have anything to put up there, you might want to think about moving that up. So I would just make that situational, depending on who you're pitching for that example. And I would probably cut the, like, how far would he go to get his life back line, because I'm like, why does he want his life back? What was so great about his life before? Because you don't really say too much about, like, does he miss the ex-girlfriend? You know, it's like, maybe that was a terrible relationship. I'm like, well, why does he want to go back to that relationship? Do you know what I mean? So I don't have a lot of context for why he liked his old life, other than humans are creatures of habit. And when things go off the rails, we think we want what we used to have. So I don't know. It just, for me, I was like, do we need that line? Probably not. And it's a bit of a rhetorical question, because we get the sense that he does, because he wants to get his life again back on track. But it seems like it's not like he wants his old life. He just wants to feel secure in what he's trying to accomplish. Does that make sense? So anyway, that's something I would think about with that. But overall, like, there's a very clear goal here, which is the wine, right? And figuring out, like, what they're going to do with that. And then there's, like, the dead body. So there is a lot of plot here. You know, CC said maybe, you know, are you showing your hand too much? Because we see so many queries that don't show their hand at all, I just feel like this is really refreshing to be like, oh, this is what the book is about. That's great. So yeah, I don't know. I felt like maybe at the bottom, when you're like, you know, convincing Lamar he's better off keeping the fake wine and preserving his reputation than turn Arthur over to the police. Like, I'm always curious, like, how late in the book that type of stuff happens versus how early that type of stuff happens. And if it happens, like, way later in the book, we probably don't need it in the query letter. But again, we can talk more in the pages about, like, sequence of events and things like that.
Thank you, Kali. Cece?
One of my favorite things is when we disagree, because I feel like it shows how subjective everything is, and because it reassures all writers out there who are thinking, no, but I think the opposite, that sometimes the two of us also feel the opposite, even though we're both agents and we have pretty similar tastes when it comes to books. I like the how far will he go to get his old life back. Like, if you had word count issues, I would agree, cut, because in fairness, I get that he wants to get his old life back. But to me, the fact that his restaurant was once the most impossible to get a reservation in already explains why he wants his old life back. In a city filled with restaurants that we all know that there are only like six at a time that actually matter, right? Like the six that everyone wants to get in. This is something that tourists never understand about New York. Like, they're always like, oh, there are all these options. Yeah, but there's only really a handful that really matter. And if you can get a table at those restaurants, then you're in. So to me, it's self-explanatory. Like, he wants his old life back because he wants the power. And I really like it. So something to consider. Like, I don't know. It's, all these things are so subjective. It's hard.
I do love the subjectivity, especially when you two disagree, because as you say, it really helps our listeners understand how very, very subjective this is. Right, we're going to hand it across to Ron now. Maybe, Ron, you can give us an indication of where in the novel these certain things happen so that we can see if they should be in the query letter or not.
Amazing. First of all, thank you both so much. That was really great to hear. You are right. It is very close to the climax. It is not after the climax, but it is sort of leading up to the climax. If it's basically after this, after the pages, it's a three-part novel, and this is probably about halfway through part three that we get in the query. So it does hit some pretty big plot points along the way. And I do think that in terms of, you know, the concern to under-explain it has sort of dogged me for a long time. So I definitely went in that direction of like, let's get as far as we can. It is not the end. Ultimately, there's deeper resolution that needs to happen. And there's a final-ish resolution that happens to the con that follows Arthur trying to convince Lamar. But that definitely is sort of the last turn, you know, on the track. And now you're sprinting towards the end.
So Carly and Cece, based on that, how do you feel now? Do you feel like he's included just enough or too much? Carly?
That's a good question, because I always feel like the right agent for you will like what you've put down. You know what I mean? So I felt like you have the right amount up until maybe like probably the last two lines. Again, I think we kind of got into more into the pages to talk about this, but like after Dale's dead body is fished out of the Long Island Sound, I feel like we should just like kind of peter off there. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like figure out a way to just have some sort of punchy last line after Dale's dead body is fished out of Long Island Sound. Da, da, da. You know what I mean? That's probably where I would chop it off. Cece?
I agree. I'm looking at the query letter. So maybe what you can do is Texas oil baron Lamar Tent purchases the entire cellar. Dale takes the money and disappears. You don't share that he loses the restaurant necessarily, because I don't think we need to know that fact. Like, I would prefer to have the question, oh my God, does that mean? And then I'll figure that out when I read the pages. You mention the dead body, and then, and you tell me if this fits your story or not, but I think it might. Once the dead body shows up, Arthur's problems escalate, because it's not just that he needs to save his restaurant or get his life back or whatever. He needs to stay out of jail. So on the one hand, he has a police investigation into the dead body, you know, and on the other hand, he needs to appease this oil baron who might be sketchy and scary in his own way. I think that the main thing to change, given that this happens up till the climax, is, I agree, the last two lines, especially the line, better off, like, he needs to convince Lamar that he's better off keeping the fake wine and preserving his reputation rather than turning Arthur over, because that is not super climaxy to me. You know, it almost seems like, okay, so he has to have a conversation with this nice oil baron person and just convince him not to turn him over. You know, like, I would have much preferred to have, like, police is on one side, oil baron is breathing down his neck on the other side. He needs to find a way to get his restaurant back or save his restaurant or whatever on the other side. Like, do you know what I'm saying? I would have much rather it not be framed as like a persuasion, you know, like he has to convince someone. I would rather it seemed like he's cornered. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, a way to simplify that is you kind of have two external conflicts. One is legal and one is illegal, right? The legal side of, I got to get my business back up and running from the legal point of view. And then the illegal one, which is like all this stuff happening and the fraud under the table. So you can have things breathing down from two sides. So think of it maybe like your legal bucket and your illegal bucket. I don't know if that helps at all.
Totally. Yeah. It's definitely, it makes a lot of sense in terms of like, what's the question that's going to drive you or other agents to want to read the whole thing. And it seems like it does read like he's going to sit down and like argue his way out of it, which, you know, at the end of the book is definitely not a lot of arguing. It's a lot of breaking glass. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. One of my questions was like, what kind of questions does this query leave you with? And it seemed like I didn't leave enough questions, you know, like we're looking at the back of a book and saying, okay, I want to know what happens, and as opposed to being like, oh, I'm cool, that happened. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Ron, remember this. We have wine, food, and murder. Like, that is a good combination. You know, like, good job. Like, everyone's going to want to read this book.
Thank you so much for that. Okay, Ron, will you give us an indication of what's in the opening pages?
Yes. So we start with Arthur Plaid on the morning of the reading of the will of his best friend, Dale Fender. He is in Washington Square Park. He's getting the only suit that he owns that's clean right now out of his restaurant. And he goes to his restaurant and has sort of a very strong memory of what he's at risk of losing. So he has this experience in the restaurant. It's a very quiet moment, which is interrupted by his father calling him and complaining about some missing olive oil and parrot food. Then that transitions to Arthur at the Fender office, where he has been told that he has to wait outside for the reading of the will. That's only family members. We get a kind of sneak peek of this very eccentric, crazy family. And Dale and his sister Prudence, who runs the company and is definitely the one in the family who has followed in her father's footsteps, whereas Dale has not, which becomes quickly apparent as Dale sort of storms out, finding out that he has been just willed his wine collection and ordering Arthur to, you know, to get out and leave with him. And Arthur has been sort of struggling internally through this entire opening with asking his friend for money, which is sort of been an unwritten rule of their friendship that doesn't happen, that Dale is wildly wealthy. Arthur is a successful businessman, but by no means rich in any stretch of the imagination. So sort of falls into the two of them riding an elevator, Dale sort of freaking out about what he has been willed, which is not at all what he expected. And Arthur coming to a question, finally finding his in, so, and just, you know, asking at the end, how much wine? And it sort of pulls Dale out of his misery. And Dale is always up for a good party and a good scheme. And he sort of follows him with, what are you thinking, Artie?
Wonderful, Ron. Thank you. That sounds very much like an excellent inciting incident. As you explain it, now we're going to find out from Carly and Cece if they agree. Carly, will you kick us off?
Absolutely. Okay, so I feel like I'm really conflicted about this opening because I wasn't sure what he was grieving or mourning for a while. It took me a while to figure that out. And because you're quietly introducing the fact that the suit was what you need to wear to a will reading, right? So we get that sense like, okay, something, you know, obviously there's a death of some kind. So there's sadness there. And then there's the sadness about the restaurant. And I never got like an emotional calibration from him about like, which of these two things is more important? Is it the combination of like the 1-2 punch, you know, that is really bringing him into this depression? It just felt like you presented him in this state of mind. And I wasn't sure how he essentially felt about, again, the 1-2 punch or the layering of these things or which of these he was grieving more. Or it was just kind of coincidence that he has to like wear this suit. There's a will read, you know what I mean? And he is way more upset about the restaurant. I don't know. I had a little trouble figuring out the emotional calibration a little bit there because it felt a little bit clinical at the beginning, right? It's like April Fool's Day, the time, the place, the coffee, the cigarette. And that made me feel like, is it in grief that he's just like, this is the situation? Or are you doing this for the reader? And if you're doing that for the reader, you don't have to do that for the reader because, you know, you can layer that in a lot of other ways as opposed to being like, it was April Fool's Day. It was a Thursday. You know what I mean? Not saying you're doing that, but you know what I mean? We don't want to just list the things. And this is why I'm conflicted because I think you do a really great job of making this a very motion forward opening. It's he is in the park, but then he's like unlocking the door, going to the restaurant, and then we go, you know, meet him at the will reading. So there is a lot of movement, but there's something about that first paragraph, I think, that's just not working for me in that sense. And I think that's why I'm like, I'm just not clear on the emotional calibration there. You know, I noted some things I really liked. Like I liked the line, in 83 days, it would be taken from me. I love a countdown, you know, that always gives us something to work towards. So I really like the countdown there. My other note is around the will reading. So there's a lot of names, right? There's like, there's him and then there's the dad and then there's like the name of the law firm and then there's the family. It's always hard because I'm as a reader, I'm like, who am I supposed to pay attention to? And obviously, you know, we have the interaction with the dad and I love the little olive oil shtick. I thought that was great. But if you don't tell me who's the most important person through story, then I don't know who I'm supposed to be paying attention to, right? And so I think we get there, obviously, through the best friend kind of conversation. But I'm almost wondering if this is like a male version of grieving and like how it's showing up on the page, because different people grieve differently. And I'm like, maybe that's just how dudes grieve. They're just like, I'm just gonna sit here and smoke my cigarette and wander over here and sit down at the will reading, you know? And maybe like my interpretation of how he is grieving as a man isn't blossoming on the page the way that I maybe expect a man to grieve. And I don't know, there is no right way to grieve or, you know, a gendered way to grieve. And maybe that's just me bringing my own opinions and feelings and biases to this experience. And then there's a lot of description in terms of the family, right? Because you're like this grotesque procession of haute couture and low class. I thought this was really interesting because as somebody who would, he has one of the most, you know, fabulous restaurants in New York, he has a very good perception of people in class and, you know, who can afford what. And so I thought it was really interesting that he could recognize, obviously, some of the fancy things that they're wearing. He can put a price tag on things like purses dangling on $10,000 chains because he would encounter those types of people in his restaurant. And yet you said haute couture and low class. He has a lot of feelings about classism, you know, who deserves wealth, who deserves to present themselves in this way. So I felt like there's so much under the surface here, so which made me think that you're actually trying to do too much in these first five pages. And especially because I do think you pitch this as like a literary mystery, if I'm not mistaken, right? And so I think we're rushing like a little bit, I think. And I really want to get in his head quite a bit more because again, there's like, they're wearing this and the lobby with the noise and the, I don't know, it's just like a bit factual, right? And it's like the mahogany door swung open and then this happened and then Prudence was this and she wore black, you know? And so I feel like there could be a different way to give us this type of information as opposed to this is what rich people wear, you know? So I would pay attention to that a little bit. And then the last thing I will touch on before I'll hand it over to Cece was there was this line where you said, I wasn't hungry anymore, period. And I patted down my suit and I was like, oh, for a chef, that was really interesting to me that he said, I'm not hungry. I wasn't hungry anymore, period. And I just felt like maybe because I think you did such a good job with that olive oil bit about like, these are the types of olive oils that you do this with. And, you know, and like, I just know that this is obviously such a specific point for this character. And the fact that it was like, I wasn't hungry anymore, period. I was like, Is that a big deal to him that he isn't hungry? Is he always hungry? What does it say about him that he's not hungry? Because I thought that was just like a perfect opportunity just to like, again, get in a little bit of that atmosphere with the foodie. And I think your foodie readers would be interested in that, because I think that's ultimately one of your target audiences is foodies. So I just wanted to make a note of that. And otherwise, you know, I just left you notes in the margins. Like, I liked this. So yeah, those are kind of my very vague notes, Ron.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, we're throwing it to you before we go back to Ron.
Okay, so I'll start from the top. In the very first paragraph, there's a line that reads, "I figured a suit was what you'd wear to a will reading." And I love that because it's such a subtle yet effective way of telling me that he's never been to a will reading and that he cares about appearances. One thing I'm always on the lookout for is how an author will share a protagonist's socio-emotional framework. So if you go to a funeral, for example, what are your associations with funerals? First time? Have you only ever seen them on TV? Is this like story of your life? You feel like you go to a funeral every month? Have you always wanted to go to a funeral? Kind of like a morbid curiosity? I don't know. So you're doing this here right from the very first paragraph, which I really, really like. And it's subtle and there's personality and it's not on the nose and it's just really great. I also really like the way you establish that the restaurant needs saving by connecting it to the people with the clipboards, you know, asking people who are walking by to save the world, save the children, save the dolphins. And, you know, you wrote, "Their innocence was a cold slap. Would save my restaurant turn a single head?" So that was really good. I really liked that. And then as I went on to the second paragraph, I read, "I unlocked the door at Jiro Rostro." And I'm going, wait, what? I thought he was sitting down at the park. Because there was no reference to movement on his part, only him observing others move. I assumed, and yes, it's an assumption, that he was sitting down at a park bench smoking cigarettes. So I would make it clear that he's cutting through the park if he is in fact doing that. Because I was confused. I was like, wait, what? Like, we were just at the park. He was observing people. I thought it was like a scene where he was still. And then all of a sudden he's unlocking the door. And I know it's a really small thing. And to be fair, it is a small thing, but it is important to be really, really specific about what is happening, like what movement's happening, etc. Okay, so I really, really like the fact that he is talking to his dad, but I think that that is a missed opportunity to establish interiority and emotionality in family dynamics. So when his dad says, "I mean, I guess the Santorini olive oil will do," what goes through his mind? Is he thinking, pretty soon there will be none of these olive oils, Dad, and you're going to have to get used to this new lifestyle? Or is he thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so guilty because, you know, my father got used to a certain lifestyle because of me. Maybe that's not the situation. I don't know what the situation is, but I wanted specific interiority, specific emotionality about that dialogue. Because right now, all we have is dialogue and dialogue tags. We don't have interiority. Okay, moving on. There's a point at which he says, "Ray's son, Dale, my best friend, insisted that I join him." Now, everyone knows how I feel about namesplaining. I get it though. Like, you do have a lot of names. So I will say, fine. Like, at some point we got a namesplain. But in order to make it less explanation heavy, I need more. Like, right now it's all information. Like, if you read that paragraph, it's all, here is information. There is no emotionality tied to it. Is it typical of Ray to be calling up on him, asking him for help? Is it rare? Was it surprising to get Ray's call? Was it a situation where it's like, yeah, my life is really messed up right now, but my friend never asks me for anything and he's been there for me before, so I feel like I have to be there for him? And obviously you'll weave this in a way that's really juicy and interesting, but I needed more so that it doesn't read explanation heavy. And also so I get to know his dynamics with his friends. Like, understanding how he relates to people is a huge, huge part of connecting with him. I want to talk about now the part where he's in the office. We get description on the office, which is really strong. And then we get a line that reads, "Fitting decor for a company whose net worth was larger than most countries." This, again, in my opinion, is a missed opportunity to tell us more about him. Is this where he'd be if he had followed the path his parents had always wanted for him, working in finance or something? Or if it weren't for that one summer that he spent in Tuscany falling in love with food, he would have gone down the corporate path. Or maybe he's looking at this and going, oh my God, is this going to be my life if my restaurant doesn't make it? Like, am I going to have to put on a suit every day? This sounds horrible. And then maybe he'd realize, oh, but I won't even get this life because they won't hire me here at this point. You know, like, I don't know. I just, again, missed opportunity because he is a fish out of water in that place, in a sense, right? Like he has a more like creative type business as opposed to like a corporate business. So I was also confused. Was he recognized? This is a question I have for you that you can answer later on. But like he walks in and the receptionist goes, Arthur Plaid, we're expecting you. Like, is he that famous? Like where people know his face? Because he didn't introduce himself. So if that's the case too, I want interiority on how it feels to be recognized. Like, does he love the fact that he's famous? Is it embarrassing? I don't know. Does he love the attention? What's the situation? I really like the line about the bagel setup, but I wanted to know what about it worked. Like exactly the bagel setup I would have ordered. That was good because it made it about him. It tied it to his interiority. But why? Because it gives everyone a little bit of what they want, because it's classy. Like I just, again, tiny, tiny detail, but I wanted it. We are getting information on Prudence. Prudence Fender, Dale's older sister, now president and CEO of Fender Capital. How does he feel about Prudence? If he's so close to Dale, he has an opinion on his sister, especially if it's like a really long friendship. Like, did he meet Prudence when she was still a teenager? Can he like not believe that she's already a CEO? Or maybe not. Maybe it's like a recent friendship. Maybe they were friends as adults. And so all he knows about Prudence is what he hears from Dale. And maybe it's hard to reconcile the person Dale vents about with this woman standing in front of him. I don't know. I just wanted, like, how does he feel about Prudence? And this is especially important because at the end, Prudence kind of screws her brother over, like in his opinion. And so it would have so much more impact if we knew a little bit more about Prudence before so we could like tie things together. I noticed that you described the receptionist as severe and then also Prudence as severe. So I would just mix that up. Like you don't want to use severe twice. And I did wonder, again, another question I have for you. I love that you're here. He's observing the people, right? Like he was put in a different room because he's not family. A, was that surprising to him? Like, is he thinking, oh my God, I came all the way here and I don't even get to be in the room? Or is he like relieved because he didn't want to be in the room? I don't know. But he's observing everyone. And there's a line that reads, they wanted more and were terrified that it could all be taken away. I wanted to judge them harshly, but I was here for the same reason. At least they were allowed in the room. And I'm like, he was here for the same reason. I thought he was there to support his friend. So I'm wondering if this is a curiosity seed. And if so, great. Let's leverage it even further by adding another one, maybe two paragraphs later, that has a little bit more detail. Like, what is his scheme? What exactly, like, is he thinking of asking his friend for a loan? You know, has he ever asked his friend for anything before? I really wanted more curiosity seeds because it's going to be really important to keep the reader curious. Another thing that I thought was odd that ties to my first note about movement in the, you know, whether he's sitting at the park or not, he's put in a room and he gets to observe everyone, but at no moment does anyone make eye contact with him. And clearly they can see him if he can see them, you know, and I know they're busy. I know they're interacting with each other, but like if there's a dude standing inside a glass room looking at you, at some point, someone's going to make eye contact with him. And so I thought that that could have been established sooner before he actually talks to his friend. Like his friend saw him from a distance, you know, gave him a look, like a silent look, like they exchanged like maybe a, I don't know, nonverbal contact or something. And then they talk. Like I thought that was weird. I just didn't know. I highlighted a paragraph for you that I think really speaks to like a big picture note, which is you're giving me description, but you're not giving me emotionality on the description. So you'll see that in my notes. Our Substack supporters will see that too. But like I wanted more emotion and I know that he might be numb and he might be dissociating and he might be like being avoidant right now, which is totally fair, but you've got to still weave in his unconscious, you know, even if it's just for a second and then he pushes it away. Because I needed, like to Carly's first point, like I needed to know how desperate he was to save his restaurant. Like grief is a process, not an emotion, as a very smart listener once pointed out, and this person is right. So like, where's the desperation? Can we access the desperation even if only for a second so that we can feel the urgency of his emotions? Okay, when he's talking to Dale, he's asking, what happened, Dale? And again, no interiority. No one in the face of the human existence has ever asked what happened without a theory going through their mind. And I needed theories going through his mind. And it needs to be wrong because no one can anticipate everything perfectly. And that interiority will really help. Oh, a very small note. Would the smoke detectors not go off since he was lighting a cigarette? Well, since Dale was lighting a cigarette. And how does he feel about that? Is he like, oh, is Dale's always breaking all the rules? People like Dale never have to worry about following the rules. Like, I just wanted more on...
Maybe he ends up vaping or something. Or if he's like, I really want a cigarette. And then he's like, God, I gotta get this damn vape or whatever. So, I don't know. Like, you could switch that up.
Yeah. Or maybe like the smoke detector doesn't go off, but he notices them and he wonders if they will, just to make it realistic. Because I also don't know how effective the smoke detectors are. I've never Thank God I've never been in an elevator where anyone has ever lit a cigarette, because that sounds horrible. I like that we're getting the line towards the very end. I'd never ask Dale for money. There were rules in a friendship like ours, unspoken but obvious. The thing is, it can't be the first time that this is occurring to him, given that he's with Dale the whole time thinking about his restaurant. So I like the line. I just don't think it's in the right place. And now I will stop talking so you can answer all our questions and ask us whatever you want.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you both. This is great. It's interesting because a lot of questions that you're asking do sort of get fleshed out pretty quickly thereafter in terms of the length of the relationship, in terms of the dynamics, the history of it. But it is telling, and this is a challenge I've faced and I'm still, is that there's this sort of blankness about Arthur in the beginning, you know, about where he is. And I think that obviously needs to get addressed. Because he is desperate. The restaurant is his home. You know, he's estranged from his father for good reason. Them living together is not a good thing. He's not in a good place. And I think that that is clearly not coming across as clearly as I'd like it to. And it's also, it's interesting, the lack of interiority, because, you know, it is a first person novel and it is, you know, rife with his thoughts later on. But right now it seems just, you know, to Carly's point, the idea that it's reading a little clinical makes sense, I guess. What I'm hearing, and I'd love to know if I'm right, is that basically what is missing right now is it being sort of emotionally grounded in a straightforward way that like just sets the scene for the reader. Am I oversimplifying that, or is that kind of the gist?
There's two thoughts that I have here, Ron. Firstly, one is what I noticed a lot of emerging writers do in those first five pages. They're so terrified of telling that they go, I'm just going to show. And so they just show the dialogue and they just show the movement because they confuse interiority and emotionality with telling. So for me, what's interesting is you've said a lot of his thinking comes later. So I have a feeling you've avoided it in the beginning because you just wanted to ground us in scene and show us all of this. I may be wrong there. I'll hand it across to Carly and Cece shortly. Something else that is coming to mind is our deep dive discussion with LaToya Watkins, which you were at. And something that really resonated with me is she said that situation informs for her so much of character and what is revealed by the character. If you put the character in the right situation, the right things about them will immediately be revealed. So I'm wondering if you've put your main character in the right situation to reveal all the things about him that we desperately need to know in those first few pages. And if you maybe reorient him and put him somewhere else, maybe those things will come to the fore much more quickly and much more naturally, perhaps in a high-pressure situation, as opposed to waiting to hear someone else's news and being with them to support them. So maybe something to think about, and for our listeners as well. Are you putting the character in the right situation that's immediately going to give all the information that we need? Carly and Cece, do you want to answer Ron's question?
Yeah, I do think that that is a fair diagnostic. I just want to clarify that it's really important to make sure that that access to his psyche has depth, because I actually think you've put him in a situation with pressure because he's there to support his friend, but he clearly has an ulterior motive because of that one curiosity seed I got. So I think that you have the right framework. You just need to go deeper. It's more about depth than it is about changing, except for one thing. And I did have this idea as I was reading it. People love getting free advice from lawyers. Probably people love getting free advice from lots of other professions too, okay? But like seriously, it's a problem when you're a lawyer. What if he's going to this law firm thinking, like with the eviction notices, with a question in his mind, and that is a very clear goal he has, and he wants to try to get, not Prudence, because Prudence is a CEO, but like whatever the lawyer's name is, trying to, hey, before the meeting starts, I have a question for you. I don't know. He wants to be like really inappropriate or something. Because that goal might help with just giving him more agency. Because right now he's observing so much. Like his dad calls about the olive oil and it's all about what his dad wants. He's there to support his friend. And his friend is going through all these things and all he's doing is observing. And again, I like observant characters. It's really good. But if we gave him something else that he was trying to accomplish short term, that might give him more agency and might help create more depth. But the opportunities for depth are there. Like when you see my notes, the written notes, you're going to be like, this is where you could do this. This is where you could do that. And just suggestions. There's a million other places that you could do a million other things. But with writers, one thing I see a lot is And I think Bea really hit the nail on the head when she said people confuse emotionality and interiority with telling. Something I see as a, I guess, common mistake, I'd frame it as, is, you know, the first pages have to establish what's happening, almost like what a camera could capture if this were a movie. And that is true. I need to know where I am. I need to know who he's with. I need to know how he's moving and where, like, what's happening. But what's more important than that is the very, very active emotions. Like, we need active emotions. If you don't have active emotions in the first five pages, I will not continue. And quiet novels do it. Thrillers do it. All unputdownable novels have active emotions. And the secret to active emotions is really activating the emotion that's already there. So really, you have a really good setup, I think. Like, these pages are really good. When this is ready, I want to read this because this is the kind of book that I like, much to the point of your query letter, which you're right. I just think you need to do more work on him and probably not more work for you because you seem to know him really well. I think more work to make it clear for the reader.
Awesome. Cece, anything else, Ron?
I'm just taking a quick look at a lot of notes. No, I mean, this it's great.
Ron has all the notes, yeah, everyone. He has like papers and pens. I love it.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to diving back in because I think one of the things I found with when I happened on this opening, and I would love to keep it here if possible, is that it allowed me to cut like legitimately 20,000 words out of a draft, which was really exciting and surprisingly not that painful. But there was the sense of like, there's so much happening. And I think, you know, just like letting it breathe a little bit more and really, you know, I'm looking forward to diving back into it and getting that because I feel like once that's established, I feel very good about the pacing and the way the story progresses and a lot of bigger picture things, but just it's always been a struggle to sort of get that right note at the beginning and the first version, second, third, fifth, or ninth. So that's really heartening to hear. And I feel like there's a lot to dig into, which I appreciate a lot.
Awesome. Don't be discouraged, Ron. My latest novel finished. Some of the listeners know I added a prologue. I felt good about the prologue. It went to my editor. Not only is my prologue now gone, she does not like my opening and I've got to go back even further. And this is a novel that I've been working on for a year and a half. So this is all part of the process and we all go through it. Just remember, very important to have that establishing shot. It's almost like a camera angle at the beginning. Make sure that the reader knows that he's busy walking through this park so that they can exactly imagine what he's doing as they then dive into his thoughts with him. That's always so incredibly important. You don't want the reader going, hold on a second, I thought he was sitting here, but now he's actually here. So just something to remember. Ron, thank you so, so much for joining us. Carly and Cece, thank you for your incredible insights as per usual. Now let's go to today's guest.
Did you know that 70% of all books are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand to build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Do you ever wonder why so many authors publish their books and later say they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and it's all over social media. Authors really think it's a them problem, but not always. They really just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I have helped clients launch books to the bestseller list for over 15 years. I have now built a 6-module, 10-hour course with all my knowledge, and that will give you the craft and book business information that you won't find anywhere else. And there's an app. Over 100 of you have already joined my new course. And writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. Thank you, Siobhan. If you want all that info and everything that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15 for the month of April at checkout. That's POD, POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Today's guest is the New York Times bestselling author of the memoir Boy Erased, as well as the creator and co-producer of the podcast Unerased, The History of Conversion Therapy in America. His work has been published by the New York Times, Oxford American, Time, and the Virginia Quarterly Review, among others. He is an assistant professor of creative writing at Kennesaw State University. It's my pleasure to welcome Garrod Conley. Garrod, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
It's wonderful to have you after reading this absolutely exquisite, exquisite book. So for our listeners, the book we're talking about today is All the World Beside. And instead of just sort of reading you the flap copy, before we get started, I'm going to ask Garrod to please read us his letter to the reader. Now, this is at the front of the advanced reader copy. It won't be in the final copies, which is especially why I'd like you to hear it. Can you read that for us, Garrod?
I love this. I love getting a behind the scenes look.
Yeah.
Yes, I'll read it. Dear reader, I truly can't believe this book is in your hands. As I've molded this project for the past 7 years, I've come to understand that the work of fiction lies not in finding answers, but in expanding the way we think about the past, the way we make assumptions, in opening up imaginative possibilities that allow us to paint the whole human canvas with the bold, bright colors we see today. The question I'm asking in this novel is, how did queer people exist, survive, and even thrive and love in centuries other than our own? Like my last book, Boy Erased, a memoir of my experience in conversion therapy, my novel, All the World Beside, enters the world at a time of great tribulation for queer people. In the past year, over 400 pieces of anti-LGBTQ legislation have been proposed, and a certain legislator in Florida has launched an all-out assault to erase queer people from existence. But the inspiration for All the World Beside emerged from a much more intimate source, a conversation between my missionary Baptist father and me, one stemming from our shared love of 18th century preachers and of religious experience. Out of this conversation came my father's insistence on a capital G God, and my insistence that queer people are and have always been equally as real as his experience of God. My novel is an attempt to hold these two truths to be self-evident. Queer Christians exist, have existed. Queer people of all religious backgrounds exist, and history will bear these truths out. No matter what anyone says in 2024 and beyond, it will still be true that my protagonist, a Puritan preacher, loved God and his family, and also loved a member of his flock, a man by the name of Arthur Lyman. That such men existed in history, that such a family existed, one where multiple queer people protected each other in the same space, is obvious to me after extensive historical research, much of which colors this novel. I hope you find the Whitfields and the Lymans to be as real to you as they are now are to me. I'm grateful to you for your support and for reading, for asking the questions, believing in us, and believing in our stories. Sincerely, Garrod Conley.
Wonderful. I really love that. I wish publishers would include these letters to the readers in the final versions as well. I don't know why they just include them in the archives.
I know. Readers,
they do love this background, right? I mean, when you meet with a book club, I don't know about you, but most of the time when I meet with book clubs, they don't speak about the book as much as what inspired it and who you are as a person, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, but I'm already biased. Boy Erased was a memoir, so I'm so accustomed to speaking about my own life. And I think, you know, what they're trying to do, I think from my publisher's perspective a lot, because you have to, right? And I think what they're trying to do is signal to the industry, hey, here's someone who wrote a memoir, but it's okay. He has the legitimate reason for writing this novel, and it's based in biography. And, you know, it's funny because I taught a sort of new criticism mode in my classes for so long where, you know, the biographical fallacy was a big no-no. Like, okay, we'll look at the biography, but we're not going to assume that, you know, this fictional text is entirely composed only out of the author's experiences. But I feel like right now, especially with our push for identities, that is at the forefront of everyone's mind is like, okay, well, why did this person write this story? And I'm, you know, I'm practical. I'm an Aries, so I just kind of go with it. I'm like, okay, well, however you want me to frame this, I'll do it. Just let me publish my novel, please.
Yeah. It's like, I just want to write. I just want to publish this book I worked on. And however you want to frame it, that's entirely up to you. So something that I want to launch off of here first is we have tons of memoir writers who listen to the podcast, and I know they're going to yell at me if I don't first begin with this.
Yes.
So in terms of Boy Erased, writing that memoir, when you pitched that, or when you got an agent for that, or when you sold that, was it a case of you already had the platform from the podcast and that preceded the memoir, or did the two work the other way around? How did that process look for you?
It's almost unimaginable that this could happen today. And that's what saddens me so much. You know, I remember my professors telling me, oh, you know, the industry changes so quickly. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll be fine. I'll adapt. But actually, Boy Erased came about, I think, out of a series of flukes. One was that I ended up going to the Sozopol Fiction Conference, which is in Bulgaria. That all of you listeners out there that are interested in traveling and getting paid to go to interesting conferences, go to this Bulgarian conference, Sozopol, S-O-Z-O-P-O-L. Anyway, that's where I ended up going, just randomly applying, getting in, and I went to the Black Sea and hung out, and that's where I met Garth Greenwell, who I'm close friends with now. And I ended up taking his position at the American College of Sofia, which you can kind of read about some of the atmosphere in his first book, What Belongs to You. And from there, I ended up meeting quite a few people who, at the next AWP in Boston, it was that AWP where there was a big snowstorm and everyone kind of got snowed in that had gone there the day earlier. And I ended up being invited to a party where I sat next to Maud Newton, who is a wonderful nonfiction writer, and she used to be a big blogger at the time. And she said, hey, do you want to go to my agent party? And I said, well, okay, you know, and she said, well, my husband can't make it because, you know, the snowstorm. And so I went to this agent party, and it was with Julie Bear's agency at the time. It was the Bear Literary Group. Now it's the Book Group. So at the time, I ended up, you know, going into this atmosphere that was very unusual to me that I'd never been in before. And Maud said, hey, here's Julie. Do you want to pitch your story? And I sat down and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to say? Because I've only written like 20 pages of what was eventually Boy Erased. And I said to her, my father's a missionary Baptist preacher. He sent me to conversion therapy. It obviously didn't work. There's the pitch. And she goes, send me some pages. And so I went back. I'd had, you know, it was open bar. I was very young, so I had way too many drinks. And I went back to my hostel and I brewed like a pot of coffee, sobered up, and wrote my first query letter that I'd ever even, you know, I had to like Google it, figure out what it was. And in a few weeks, she signed me. And it was so absurd that I often don't tell my students until like the end of class, because I don't want them to hate me or be like, you know, think that that's how it all works. But I mean, the one thing that I learned from that experience is that luck is a huge part of our careers, right? Like just getting it in front of the right pair of eyes, getting someone who understands your book. And the beginning of Boy Erased was a pretty rocky adventure. I had zero following. I was, no one knew about my work. I hadn't really published anything. And so at the beginning, I think no one was really expecting it to do that well. And what we learned, you know, 30 publishers, it was sent out to 30 publishers and only, I think, three responded, and then the other two backed out. So I ended up with, you know, Riverhead, which is such a great publisher, but, you know, it could have easily gone a different way. And then from that, what we learned was that there was just such a hungry audience for this content, which, you know, at the time, I think there'd been maybe, I don't know, a few memoirs that were published on conversion therapy. I can't really remember, but none of them were very high profile. And if you saw it in a film, you know, it was kind of a comedy, like But I'm a Cheerleader, which is a great movie with Natasha Lyonne and RuPaul randomly as one of the counselors. But it was always treated in this sort of comic light. And there hadn't been a real serious dramatic treatment of it. And I think I just lucked out. I mean, it's weird to talk about luck with a conversion therapy story because, you know, I would gladly trade not going to conversion therapy for this. But I do think that a huge amount of luck and also just appetite was involved. And these are things that we could have never predicted. Like publishing could have never predicted that Boy Erased would be this kind of success. I guess I'm a little befuddled with the industry after that because I'm like, I don't really know what's going on because I never knew what was going on.
Well, a few things to unpack there. One, I feel like the universe owed you some luck. So I'm glad that it delivered to balance that shit out. Two, luck is hugely, hugely important in this industry. And, you know, we're running a virtual retreat at the moment called the Deep Dive Series. And one of the things we said to a lot of the delegates was get your elevator pitch ready, even if work isn't finished, because you never know who you might meet where you suddenly have to be like, this is what my book is about. And when you went out that night, you weren't thinking I'm going to have to deliver an elevator pitch.
No, but you know, it's funny because I had always had this kind of reaction to conversion therapy where I would say something to just get us past the conversation, like, oh, well, you know, I went there, it didn't work, haha, you know, it's crazy, it's a good place to find a date, none of which were true. It's a terrible place to find a date, by the way. You'll never get out of that nosedive of a relationship because you got too much baggage. But, you know, I think because I had created this shorthand for it that was kind of pithy and funny, it still kind of worked. You know, I would never pitch it that way to Julie Pear, of all people. But I think a little bit of ignorance helped me because I had this ridiculous confidence, given the fact that I never thought in a million dreams that she would say, send me some pages. You know, this is never going to work. So let me just be honest.
And I love that. I love that it was the luck there. And putting that kind of pitch together, I agree. You know, when I was chatting with Stephen Rowley, he was talking about how he first pitched Lily and the Octopus, which is why he couldn't get an agent. I mean, he was about to self-publish that book because he kept telling people it's about a dog with an octopus on its head. Right? And people are like, I don't think I want to read that. And instead of him saying it's a book about grief and love and whatever, he just pitched it all wrong until he finally figured out how to do that. So, you know, I feel like the way you did it, as you say, it was probably refreshing. It was raw. It wasn't super polished. And sometimes that is what's going to grab an agent's attention. But for our listeners who write memoir, the takeaway here is so encouraging because you keep getting told you need a million followers. You need a big platform. And, you know, Garrett didn't have that. And he still published a memoir that was hugely, hugely successful. So, you know, there's that to be encouraged by.
It's always such a challenge, you know, when teaching to try to tell students that, okay, it is about the writing, but you also have to find an agent and an editor who like good writing and are willing to take a risk, because that's what it is, right? Like, they're weighing your talent versus, you know, how much it's going to cost to make it, and is it worth it? Is it going to like be up for awards and things like that? And that's, you know, I will say that that's a harder track, right? I didn't know that at the time, but literary fiction, of course, as we know, is not exactly thriving. So it is a different challenge, I think, but it's doable. I've seen people signed for their prose all the time.
Yeah, and just bouncing off of that, you know, I feel like the luck is even more in, you say to students, you need to find an agent and an editor who will appreciate the good writing, but it's their particular style of writing, because writing can objectively be good, right? But it may not resonate with a particular editor or a particular agent. And that's, again, where the luck comes in.
It is. It's luck. It's also, I guess, one route is to obsessively read a certain editor's writers and see if you can kind of understand the style that they enjoy. You know, when you look at FSG or something, just using someone we were talking about earlier, you know, knowing that they publish Garth Greenwell is helpful if you are, you know, a young aesthetic gay who wants to write beautiful sentences, right?
Yeah.
So that does help a little bit, but it is still mostly luck, I think.
Yeah, yeah. The query trenches are tough. Okay, so let's come back to this book, All the World Beside. So you, Garrett, have called it the Queer Scarlet Letter. And for our listeners, you know, we've got this book that's based in Cana, Massachusetts, a utopian vision of 18th century Puritan New England. And so, I mean, we can immediately see the parallels there. But you also said it took you 7 years to write. Can you tell us a bit about that process, how much of it was reliant on the Scarlet Letter, if you just use that as a sort of platform to jump off of? I'd be really interested in hearing more about that.
Great. It's my favorite thing to talk about. My husband, Shahab, actually dared me one night to write a Queerton pure love story. Queerton.
That should now be a new word. I feel like it should really be a new word.
Puritan queer love story. And I said, that's completely absurd. There's no way I could pull that off. First of all, our identity categories don't map into the 18th century. You know, I had a master's degree in 18th century literature, and I knew that it would be a real challenge to get it right. But then the idea wouldn't let go because Shahab is incredibly smart, and I know that he reads a ton. And so he probably saw a gap, and I thought, okay, well, let me just try to see what I would do if I made that narrative. And I ended up reading almost all of Jonathan Edwards's sermons, which he, those of you who are listening, you may have heard of him from a pretty scarring sermon that you might have had to read as a child called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, in which he compares the sinner's soul to a spider dangling over a giant candle flame and like its legs curling from the fires of hell.
Some pleasant bedtime reading, yes?
Yeah, very pleasant. But he's so much more than that. And I didn't know that until, you know, I kind of felt it out with my dad, who's a preacher. And I said, what do you think of Jonathan Edwards? And he pointed to his bookshelf that had all the volumes. And so I started reading Jonathan Edwards almost as a way to connect with my dad. We actually read poetry and talk about it a lot, which is surprising for a lot of people who think about a missionary Baptist preacher in Arkansas. But he's very interesting. And so we started to both talk about and read Jonathan Edwards. And what I learned was, yes, he's a very troubled individual. He is, you know, much of his theology is odious to us today, but he also was trying a lot of new things and he had a very poetic soul. You could feel his poetic soul being forced into a kind of puritanical thought process of everything must have utility. Nothing beautiful can simply be beautiful. It must be utilitarian. It must be for God in some way, or a kind of symbol of something in heaven, like almost like a Platonic form. And so I read him, loved his language. I thought, okay, well, wouldn't it just be even more daring if I made my main gay character, you know, using the term that we use today, a minister in the 18th century and model him after Jonathan Edwards. And so that's what I started to do. And thinking, really, I've got to get the language down first, because the language is the hardest for me. And how do I create a kind of melding of 18th century and 21st century prose? Is that even possible? Will it sound ridiculous? And so I started reading, you know, everything I could about the period from both scholars who were looking at it just, you know, in terms of history. And then I also read a lot of queer scholars on 18th century political identity and gender identity. And so I divided everything up over, like, you know, I started looking into material culture, you know, what did the walls feel like? I have an image database of every single object that's in the rooms in my book, because I was so worried about getting the furniture wrong and the details wrong. And what's funny is you end up cutting like 70% of that, right?
Yeah, because you want to get all the facts right, and then you realize it's slowing down the pacing of the story.
Yes, I had to sacrifice so many things where I was like, that was a day of research, oh well. But I think that ultimately that work creates a sort of background aura for the writer where they feel confident. I mean, so much of writing is just like kind of a shell game, or just like convincing yourself that you can do something that seems impossible. And so doing all that research was really helpful for me in just giving myself the confidence. Once I had the language, the material reality, my understanding, probably my poor understanding of, you know, queer theory through the ages, I felt like I could, you know, now I'm going to make the heart of the book, right? I'm going to go ahead and try to write emotionally after I've done all this research. And that was the real challenge, is turning this highly analytical process into something that felt organic and true to my own life experiences, because there are certain universal experiences I believe that humans have. And so I was trying to build into that, but it was so hard to get in. You know, it was like, I think the research, we could realistically say the research took about 2 years, and the rest of it was, I think, 16 drafts, so many different cerebral experiments. I actually really loved the beginning. I haven't read all of it, but Justin Torres's new book, Blackouts. And I was like, that's the book I would have written if I'd been more analytical, you know? And it was actually interesting to see that I could have gone down that path. And there are a lot of writers who would. But I remember just thinking, well, I want to make a kind of homage to Hawthorne. And Hawthorne is so You know, his sentences are absolutely stunning, but he really has this almost sentimental understanding of humans. And it's very beautiful to me. It's very sacred to me. And so that's really what I wanted to capture in the book. And that took a lot of edits. That took my editor telling me over and over again, like, okay, this is really well written. I don't feel anything. what do the characters really want? And it's so hard for me, being trained in sort of the MFA world, to walk up right to the edge of the line of melodrama and say, okay, I'm just going to kind of peer over. We're going to see how far can we go into melodrama without it being too melodramatic. So those were the big challenges that I had.
Yeah, it is interesting what you say about the MFA and melodrama, because you know what, the most beautifully crafted sentences in the world will, yes, make a reader pull out a highlighter and sort of highlight how beautiful the sentences are, you know, on the line level. But if it doesn't make them feel anything, if the beauty of that sentence doesn't evoke something in them, then the writer has failed. And, you know, we sometimes see how just the simplest line can be like a spear right into the heart of the truth of the matter. And we see with a lot of emerging writers, they seem to think that literary fiction is purple prose. I call it jazz hands writing. It's like, look, Ma, I'm writing, you know, and it's like really over the top. But sometimes, you know, the simpler the language, the more beauty can be revealed in it. And I think that's the part where editing and polishing and pushing and pulling back is so important.
It's so important and it's so difficult. I've learned to love that process now. I think this is the first time I've ever loved it. Where was I? Oh yeah, I was at McDowell for a fellowship and I was surrounded by all these writers who, you know, definitely edited more than I ever did. And I actually took about 2 weeks there. I'd planned to work on a different project, but I took about 2 weeks during that time and I just edited. I read every sentence out loud so many times and I tested everything and I auditioned it or whatever, you know, it was so intense that I actually lost track of what I was doing, you know, 5 or 6 hours and, you know, just be reading aloud obsessively for hours. And it was so fun because once you get to that stage of, okay, I have a story, I did my research, I have characters, they're doing things, it feels like a real world, then you get to really have fun with the sentences and you get to cut and feel so clean after you cut something that you thought was essential, but now is absorbed into some other part of the book. I loved the whole process.
For me, the funniest part is when you get to draft 14 and there's been one sentence or one paragraph that you've clung to furiously through all other 13 drafts.
Yes,
and you were like, always. This cannot possibly go. And by draft 14, you're like, okay, take it.
You're like, I hate it now.
So there were so many parts of the book that I highlighted because the language was just beautiful. It was so lyrical. And then I realized how emotional truth can be so much more powerful than the beauty of a sentence, because this is probably one of your most simple sentences in the book, but I highlighted it and underlined it because it resonated with me so much. It says, "Much of being a woman is rendering all effort invisible." And I got goosebumps from that because, you know, as a woman, I know that. Like, I've experienced that my whole entire life. But to see it summed up in that one sentence was just mind-blowing for me. And it applied then and it applied today because we're expected to wear the, like, no makeup makeup that makes it look like we're not wearing makeup. But that shit takes longer to put on than if we were wearing, like, you know, jazz hands makeup, for example.
Yeah, and you can't win. Like, the minute that people start being more equitable about representation or, you know, you have something that shouldn't be controversial on the front of, like, Sports Illustrated or something, right? The minute that that happens, there's so much backlash that you might as well just be back in Salem, you know? It's like, it's so messed up. And I'm so glad you brought that up because one of the big challenges of this book was to counterbalance the focus on the male characters and their love with a very real experience of being a woman at that time. Because the book is really interested in gender, but it explores it kind of in a sneaky way at first, where you get the sense that one of my characters, Ezekiel, would be non-binary according to our terms today. And you see Catherine, the mother of Ezekiel and the wife of Nathaniel, really struggling quite a lot. And Sarah, her daughter, who is brought up in a household that you know, on one side is the most strict possible household. And on the other, she's seen, you know, something that is very wrong according to the time period. And she's very confused by what she saw. And I wanted to capture a young girl navigating all of that. And I kept thinking, am I qualified to do this? You know, but every time I thought that, I thought, okay, well, Hawthorne did it pretty well. You know, Hawthorne was pretty conservative, actually, during his lifetime, but he managed to write this book that really transcended his own political values and spoke to, really, I think, a lot of the struggles that women went through. And of course, it's very idealized, and there's things we could take to task with his portrayal of women. But I do think that, for the most part, he got it right. And so I really wanted to show a sort of a broader spectrum of the experiences of that time and not just focus in on these two gay male leads, which is what we always do, right? Like that's what media always wants anyway. And women write gay male characters quite frequently too, yeah. Right? And so I just wanted to kind of say to the reader, okay, you think you're getting into this story, but there's a whole other story underneath it, which is the family that deals with all of this. And I think I was qualified to write that because I'm a preacher's kid. You know, like, we know the cost, you know, we know the cost of what it's like to be a PK.
It really took me by surprise because I was expecting the centering of, you know, the two male gay characters, which is what I came to it for. And then it just gave me so much more, you know, to be reading a book like this and then to find a line that resonates with me as a woman was a huge, huge surprise and just an absolute gift. Garrett, we are now at the end of our time. I actually have like four more pages of questions which we didn't get to, but that's always a sign of a really, really good conversation. So for our listeners, we are linking to the book All the World Beside on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Get it there. You'll support an independent bookstore and the podcast and Garrett at the same time. Garrett, we wish you much success and much joy launching this book and getting it out into the world.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure talking with you.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new two-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.